is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhibi in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Of course, I'm disappointed. I expected and hoped that I was going to be set free today. But, well, it is what it is.
That's Zimbabwean journalist Jeffrey Moyo. After a court ruled his trial on immigration charges should continue. Details coming up. Also, the leader of Somaliland is urging the international community to recognize his territory's quest for independence. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Zimbabwean freelance journalist Jeffrey Moyo had to present his defense in court today after a magistrate dismissed his application for a discharge of the case. Reporter Kudzanai Musenge has more on the story.
A regional magistrate in Bulawayo, Mark Nzira, on Tuesday ruled that Moyo is to present his defense, saying the state presented enough evidence to show that he has a case to answer. Moyo is facing a charge of breaching sections of the country's Immigration Act. He is accused of helping New York Times journalists Christina Goldbaum, an American, and Joao Silva from South Africa enter the country illegally after fraudulently acquiring accreditation for them in May 2021. The two were deported 4 days after they arrived. Moyo's legal team, led by prominent human rights lawyer Beatrice Mtetwa, had applied for a discharge at the close of the state's case last month. Kathleen Mpofu, another of Moyo's lawyers, spoke with VOA.
The magistrate dismissed the application. He basically found that the state had laid enough evidence for Mr. Moyo to be put to his defense. As a result of this ruling, we'll be continuing with the trial on the 28th of April 2022, and the defense will be opening its case and will start leading their witnesses.
Moyo told VOA he is confident of winning the case.
Of course, I'm disappointed. I expected and hoped that I was going to be set free today. But, well, it is what it is. I think at the end of it all, I shall be acquitted.
Following his arrest, Moyo was detained for over 3 weeks in May 2021 before being granted bail. His co-accused, Tabang Manika, a senior employee of the Zimbabwe Media Commission, or ZMC, was acquitted a week ago in a separate trial on charges of helping the journalist. The ZMC is a statutory body that accredits all journalists in the country. If convicted, Moyo faces a maximum sentence of up to 10 years imprisonment. In a statement after the arrest of the two, New York Times said it was deeply troubled over Moyo's prosecution, which it said appeared designed to suppress press freedom in Zimbabwe. The New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists is among several groups that also condemned Moyo's arrest, saying it was an example of the continued harassment of journalists in the country. Reporting for VOA from Lawayo, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
Cameroon's government says it will rebuild hospitals and clinics destroyed by Boko Haram terrorists along the border with Nigeria. In a visit to the area this week, officials said the facilities were needed for villagers who have suffered from the conflict, as well as for former Boko Haram members who have been rehabilitated. Mokedwin Kindeka reports from Yaounde.
Cameroon's Ministry of Public Health says at least 35 hospitals along the country's border with Nigeria have either been abandoned by medical staff or destroyed by Boko Haram terrorists. Minister of Public Health Manaoda Malachi this week visited some of the remaining hospitals along the border.
On a trouvé un personnel motivé à prodiguer des soins aux populations.
He says although working and living conditions are very difficult, the few medical staff members in former Boko Haram prone towns and villages are doing their best to save lives. Malachi says Cameroon's President Paul Biya has ordered his government to build and equip destroyed hospitals and recruit more health workers. He also says he asked several hundred hospital workers who fled Boko Haram terrorism to return to Cameroon's border with Nigeria. Malachi did not say when the hospitals would be rebuilt, but Cameroon's government says it will spend $300 million this year to reconstruct what Boko Haram destroyed, including hospitals and medical equipment. Government troops have been fighting Boko Haram along the northern border with Nigeria since 2014. Cameroon's military says there have been about 25 cases of abductions and kidnappings for ransom this year, but no large-scale attacks by the terrorist group. The military says the return to peace has allowed several thousand internally displaced persons and former Boko Haram members to return to their villages. But healthcare in the region is sorely lacking, say social worker like Jean-Pierre Nglen in Kolofata district via a messaging application. Len says youths of between 15 and 35 years old are a majority of the 150 people suffering from mental health disorders that the Kolofata Hospital has received since January. He says trauma from seeing people dying or forcefully separated from loved ones, poverty, and risky living conditions are the highest causes of mental health disorders in Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. Len says the Kolofata Hospital receives hundreds of patients every day, but has only 7 healthcare workers. Speaking to Cameroon State Radio CRTV this week, Far North Region Governor Mijiyawa Bakari said the military has been helping civilians while they wait for the government to rebuild hospitals.
Nos forces de défense se sont mis aux côtés des populations.
Bakari says most Cameroon's troops deployed to fight Boko Haram have been sent to border villages to provide health care and education to both returnees and militants who surrender and leave the terrorist group. He says Cameroon's military health unit visits border villages to provide humanitarian assistance and treat sick returnees, former fighters, and the host community. Bakari said thousands of Boko Haram fighters and supporters have defected from the terrorist group since last May, when the leader of the Nigerian militants, Abubakar Shekau, was declared killed. The United Nations says the Boko Haram conflict, which started 13 years ago in northeast Nigeria, has killed more than 350,000 people and displaced 2 million across Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The leader of Somalia's semi-autonomous region of Somaliland, Muse Bihi Abdi, is urging the international community to recognize his territory's quest for independence. At an event yesterday held by the research organization, the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., Abdi said years of talks with Somalia had failed to resolve the issue. The Associated Press reports that Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation, said he thinks the U.S. and Somaliland should be strong partners. Somaliland's territory of more than 3 million people broke away from Somalia in 1991. Since then, despite the lack of international recognition, Somaliland has maintained its own independent government, currency, and security system. Somalia, however, still sees Somaliland as part of its territory. Human Rights Watch has accused Mali's military of killing at least 71 civilians since December. Mali's military government, however, is contesting the findings. Reuters reports that Mali's government told Human Rights Watch that it was investigating a number of abuses outlined in the report. However, the government denied involvement in the gravest incident, a mass execution in which the burned bodies of 35 civilians were found. Mali is attempting to counter an Islamist insurgency that has swept across the country since 2012. Also, French news agency AFP reports French journalist Oliver Dubois, who was taken hostage by militants in Mali almost a year ago has been seen in a video circulating on social media. He seemed to be in good health in the video as he urged his country to do its best to obtain his release. In South Africa, the large African migrant community and human rights groups are concerned that a new wave of xenophobic violence is about to begin in the country. They say some politicians and so-called operations to drive migrants out of South Africa are blaming foreigners for government failures, such as high unemployment and poor delivery of basic services. Large contingents of police are present in several townships to try to prevent attacks on immigrants. Darren Taylor reports.
Nhlanhla Lux is leading the latest charge against migrants. His group's called Operation Dudula, and he says it intends to push all undocumented foreigners out of South Africa.
Comrades, I'm saying to you, thank you for the discipline. High discipline! High morale!
High discipline!
I'm going to allow the other commanders to continue.
At anti-migrant protests, Lux, in his late 20s, is easily recognizable in his military fatigues and dark sunglasses. With an unemployment rate of almost 40%, with 7 out of 10 young people who should be working jobless, says Lux, South Africa can't afford millions of migrants.
When South Africans stand up to express how they feel, it's a problem. But when people are doing the wrong thing, it's not a problem.
Human rights lawyer Sharon Ekambaram says foreigners are not stealing jobs from South African citizens. Rather, she says, many migrants create employment while the government's jobs programs fail because of bad economic policies.
It's important that we are able to challenge and debunk some of the myths that are deliberately spread when, you know, opportunists like Operation Dudula are deliberately scapegoating migrants for very serious problems that we are facing in our country today.
Ekambaram says people from other African countries stream into South Africa because of political persecution and other reasons.
South Africa needs to be understanding, are we seeing an increase in the movement of people forcibly displaced because of the climate crisis, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa? And in that way, we can ensure that our response is proportionate to the problems that we're facing, as opposed to blaming the very people that have no choice but to leave their homes, their families, in order to survive.
But Lux and others say South Africans can't afford to worry about crises elsewhere on the continent when they're locked into their own battles to survive. He says the government ignores the plight of South Africans who are suffering at the hands of gangs of foreign criminals. He points out that when police recently cracked several gangs of cash-in-transit robbers, almost all those arrested were from Zimbabwe and Mozambique.
When people come to this country and do not observe or uphold the laws of this country, which humans are they respecting? South Africans, we're also humans. I asked Human Rights Commission of this country, which humans are you protecting? Only some groups of people are humans and some are not.
Some political leaders in the country have recently spoken against immigrants, which has given fuel to groups like Operation Dudula. Since 2008, South Africa has seen periodic waves of anti-migrant protests that at times have flared into deadly violence. There are fears that the current wave of protests is primed to explode. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Police in Uganda have arrested author and activist Norman Tumihimbisi, along with 8 journalists. Yesterday's arrest comes just over a month after Ugandan author Kakuwenza Rukir Bashaija fled into exile following his detention on charges of insulting President Yoweri Museveni and his son. Tumuhimbisi, who heads a local pressure group, the Alternative Movement, an online media platform, Alternative DigTalk, was due to publish a book critical of President Museveni on March 30th. A Ugandan police spokesman told the French news agency AFP that police got the complaint the group was involved in offensive communication and promoting hate speech. Government critics say Uganda has witnessed a series of crackdowns aimed at stamping out dissent, with journalists attacked, lawyers jailed, election monitors prosecuted, and opposition leaders muzzled. The United Nations advisor on Libya, Stephanie Williams, said the UN remains a key force in potentially resolving the dispute between Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Dbeibah and his rival Fatih Bensaga. She said the issue is a Libyan one that ultimately requires a Libyan solution. Williams said she was offering to use her position to mediate between Bensaga and Dbeibah to help usher a new age of stable leadership in Libya. Former Austrian military attaché to Libya, Wolfgang Porstai, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi about whether there is a feasible Libyan solution to the rival government's problem.
As it looks now, one of the two will prevail, because two parallel governments won't be sustainable over a longer period of time, especially as this is not about East versus West as it was before. Both have their hubs in their power bases in the city of Misrata, in the same city. The decisive factors for success of Bensaga or Dbeibah are the support of the militias in Tripoli to physically occupy or keep the prime minister office and the other government buildings in Tripoli, and equally important, the support by Central Bank of Libya Governor Al-Kabir, who is the one providing funding to a government. Last Thursday evening, the situation was already about to escalate. Several of the most powerful pro-Bensaga Misrata brigades made their way to Tripoli via the coastal road and via Tahuna in the hinterland to join the Misrata brigades, the Halbus, in Tripoli and occupy several key positions in the capital. But since this move was widely published beforehand in the media and social media, pro-Dbeibah militias had set up several roadblocks on the coastal road. Fortunately, the Misrata stopped at these roadblocks and did not attempt to force them and to march onward by force. Instead, they turned back and avoided a bloody fight. Bensaga continues to stress that he will take over power in Tripoli without bloodshed. But as it looks now, Bensaga is slowly losing the initiative.
Williams said she was offering to use her position to mediate in the dispute between Bensaga and Dbeibah in order to help finally usher in a new age of stable leadership in Libya. Would that stand in a chance of success?
Yes, UN Special Advisor of the Secretary General Williams and US Special Envoy Norland are pushing Bensaga and Dbeibah to meet in person and find a solution. And this could be a way forward. The influence of Williams is certainly in the meantime quite limited. She is also not really trusted by many Libyans anymore, and more frequently criticized for interfering in Libyan affairs. One could argue this is exactly what she is here for. But maybe if the meeting really happens, Williams could facilitate a solution. Dbeibah could be willing to hand over to Bensaga if he gets guarantees that he is allowed to run for presidency and that he will not be charged for any wrongdoings, especially financial wrongdoings, during his time as a prime minister. However, I'm not sure that Bensaga, Williams or Norland are the ones who are able to guarantee this. Williams and Norland have repeatedly stressed, as you've mentioned, that the decision about the prime minister is a Libyan internal affair and they favor neither side. Quite interesting. While Egypt already officially supports Bensaga, probably out of concern about the stability of eastern Libya, in the case Dbeibah continues, Turkey did not yet favor one of them, at least not in public.
As for the dispute over the constitutional basis for the postponed elections, Williams said, "I have also announced an initiative to convene a joint committee of the House of Representatives and the High Council of State to establish a sound constitutional basis in order to take the country to national elections as soon as possible." What's your take on that initiative?
The House of Representatives and the High Council of State have already agreed on an amendment of the constitutional agreement and also on a roadmap towards elections. Although this agreement was later on questioned by some members of the High Council of State, I don't think it is a particular good idea that Williams undermines this process, which is a real Libyan process. As it looks now, neither the HOR nor many of the High Council of State have an appetite to participate in this initiative. Actually, several influential House of Representative members sharply rejected the initiative and blamed Williams for trying to undermine the credibility of the House of Representatives.
That was former Austrian military attaché to Libya, Wolfgang Porstei, who spoke with my colleague Mohamed El-Shenawi. Algeria is a potentially significant contributor to U.S. efforts to ensure that Europe does not experience a major shortage in natural gas supply as a result of the Ukraine crisis. Algeria would not by itself be able to fully compensate for a shutoff of Russian gas supplies to Europe. Reporter Angie Omar discussed Algeria's possible role and how that could help in solving the gas shortage in Europe with Morgan Brazilian, the director of the Payne Institute and a professor of public policy at the Colorado School of Mines. Previously, he was a lead energy specialist at the World Bank.
It should go some way to helping, but it will not solve it. So right now, Algeria is, I think, the third largest gas provider to the EU behind Russia and Norway. It's sending natural gas through pipelines to Spain and Italy, as well as has a liquefied natural gas LNG terminal. But its overall volume, say at about 30 to 40 billion cubic meters compares to, you know, something like 140, 150 billion cubic meters from Russia. So it's still relatively small, but it is one of the better chances, along with Norway, to get incremental natural gas into Europe, and there is room for growth.
Algeria's state energy firm is ready to supply Europe with more gas in the case of a possible decline due to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So Sonatrach CEO Taoufik Hakkar said the firm was ready to pump additional gas to the European Union from its surplus via the Transmed pipeline linking Algeria to Italy. Would Algeria be able to use that pipeline to ease the shortage in Europe?
Well, it does seem that the Algerian energy company has stood up here and said that they're willing to provide more natural gas. I think that's a good thing. It does seem like it would, most of that incremental, in other words, additional gas would come through the Transmed pipeline to Italy. And so that would be most welcome, I'm sure, and helpful. All of that said, Algeria is also dealing with its increased demand for natural gas domestically from its own country, and it has some issues in increasing supply for reasons due to conflict and other domestic issues. But yes, the additional support from the North African country to help ease this, you know, acute, what could be a really acute European gas crunch, would be most welcome to everyone in Europe, I imagine.
Do you think the current high energy prices could benefit some countries on the African continent, such as Algeria, Nigeria, and Libya?
Yeah, so there is an enormous potential and in some cases reserves of natural gas on the continent of Africa, both in North Africa and in Sub-Saharan Africa. And when you're talking about the Sub-Saharan African producers, say, Nigeria or Tanzania, the high prices give good signals for future development and expansion, but they would not make a significant, I don't think they'd make a significant impact in the short term, like what we could see from Algeria.
Morgan Brazilian, the director of the Payne Institute and a professor of public policy at the Colorado School of Mines. He was speaking with reporter Angie Omar. In Basketball Africa League action yesterday, Rwanda Energy Group had a narrow win over Union-supportive Monastir, 77-24. It was the first loss for Monastir, which now stands at 4 wins, 2-1 loss. Rwanda Energy Group is at 3-1 in the standings. Also, at the Dakar Arena last night, association-supportive Dassal defeated Seydou Legacy Athletic or SLAC 91-81. SLAC now stands at 2-3 in the rankings, while Dassal is 2-2. In tonight's action, Beira takes on Rwanda Energy Group at 17:30 UTC, while Dassal faces Dakar University Club at 2100 UTC. You can follow the games on voanews.com and get all the post-game details on the sunny side of sports on Twitter and Facebook. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington.